then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's February the 6th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, this week we'll start with the NF housekeeping part, so all you people who are tuning in looking for movement gossip while you sit around in front of your computers waiting for Godot, perk up your ears. Now, the fifth edition of the White Book is turning out to be just as much of a publication bitch as I suspected it would be. Now, for one thing, I sent out the semi-final PDF file last week, and people are still finding typos and spelling errors in it. Then, as it happened, last week was the end of the month, and once I finished last week's Radio Free Northwest, I had no time to deal with the White Book, because I had to leap right into the February Northwest Observer, which went into the mail on Saturday, February the 1st. In other words, we made our deadline once again, as we now go into our eighth year. Now, that's very important, since Northwest Observer is now only one of three regular racial periodicals remaining in this country that are issued on a sufficiently timely basis to be worthy of the name, the other two being Willis Cardo's American Free Press and Olaf Childress's The First Freedom. Now, there may be others out there, I hope so, but I'm not familiar with them, and people usually send me copies of publications. Everybody else in our wee little subculture has fled into the fantasy world of the internet, where we can listen to the echoes of our own screaming and cackling. So only us three old-timers, me and Cardo and Childress, put out a hard paper publication anymore that elderly people and prisoners and other people without access to computers can actually hold in their hands. Something real and physical that exists outside a computer screen. Of those three, the NF is the only group that has succeeded in creating even small local communities. Cardo's people still occasionally have quiet little dinners in rented restaurant or motel banquet rooms because no one has any property that they're willing to donate for the purpose. I mean, you know, the kind of thing many of us will be familiar with from back in the day, where you get the same old 40 or 50 faces every time, some of whom will have driven for 10 or 12 hours down the interstate to get there. There's so few of us left. Now, I don't know about Childress in Alabama. Maybe he does the rented motel banquet room thing as well. I won't say the Northwest Front has never done that. We have. When I first arrived up here in the Puget area, we did a couple of get-togethers in restaurants. This is one of the reasons that I've been so often accused of being obsessed with a headquarters, the edifice complex, as some call it. I remember the days when everybody and his dog in the movement had a building, and you could actually meet people without having to keep your voices down to a whisper for fear of being overheard by the WOG or Mexican waiters. And I'm rambling again, sorry. I'm sure there are the usual intermittent sporadic movement attempts to put out a publication still going on out there somewhere, the odd little corner-stapled newsletter here and there. I know because I occasionally do get them in the mail, but only we three, me and Cardo and Childress, can actually meet a deadline and have a track record of regular, on-time publication over a period of years. Now, some of you may email me and say, well, what about so-and-so? I think you'll find that the publications in question are either neoconservative, with all the money in the world and almost no racial tinge at all, or else their scholarly journals, mostly of a revisionist nature, which are always, always months behind schedule, and that basically publish whenever they can raise the money, and when whoever the editor is supposed to be can tear himself away from all the other things in his wonderful, fulfilling American life and actually devote a little time to the journal. There now, you see? I obeyed the prime directive, and I didn't name any names, did I? Basically, although many of these scholarly journal-type efforts are pretty good and worth reading when they do come out, most of them essentially are the hobbies of a small clique of elderly eccentrics who need something to spend their money on in their golden years. Now, we in the movement have never been short of intellectual talent that can produce brilliant written work, which is read by a total audience of about 300 people. Among other things, I believe that we now need to concentrate on producing equally brilliant video and audio, cinema, and graphic novels, since we are living in an age where literacy is declining as young white people become niggerized, and this is a whole different skill set. One of the reasons that I myself probably will not be writing any more novels. The fact is, young white kids these days just don't read books anymore, and if they do, I've already got 5 of them for them to read. We need to start concentrating on things with pretty pictures, since we've kind of regressed back to the level of the Stone Age, where we're drawing pictures on the cave walls. Okay, back to the 5th edition of the White Book. Now, those of you who are on the special lists, plus the FBI agents who are monitoring our special lists and reading our emails without a warrant, you will be familiar with some of the specific problems we're running into with this one. I'm sorry to state that it may be as long as a month before the 5th edition White Book is available in actual hard copy book form. But we'll find out once I can get into it, which will hopefully be sometime later this week. Now, another housekeeping note from the 5th edition White Book. Secure mailing address. You need one. Now, before I get into that topic, though, someone recently sent me an article from the New York Times from last July revealing how the organs, as Solzhenitsyn described them, are still using an expanded version of the old-fashioned J. Edgar Hoover-style mail cover, and this article confirmed the fact that the post office photocopies the outside of every single piece of mail which is dropped into a mailbox in this country. Jesus Christ, no wonder they're going broke and never turning a profit and stopping Saturday deliveries if that's what they're wasting their time and their money on. So, no, you can't escape the Democrat surveillance state by using the post office, but you can make your communications harder to intercept. Now, technically speaking, the FBI does still require a warrant to open a piece of first-class mail, and for all I know, some of them may still respect that. It's not strictly necessary, since under post-9/11 law, all that has to happen is that a U.S. attorney, or possibly even an assistant U.S. attorney, can declare a case or an investigation to be quote-unquote terrorist-related, whatever the hell that means. And then they can open all your mail, or intercept it, or make it disappear, or whatever. For example, about 90% of Edgar Steele's mail apparently just disappears. His captors are either squirreling it away in plastic tubs in some sub-cellar in the Victorville prison, or, for all anyone knows, they may be just burning or shredding Edgar's mail, and it's all perfectly legal. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make these bastards work. Don't let them just sit in their cubicles, slurping on raspberry smoothies or whatever, and violate your constitutional rights by clicking a mouse. Make these motherfuckers put on their expensively tailored coats. Go outside into the cold and the rain, get into their cars, and drive through lunchtime traffic to some postal substation, where they will have to find a place to park before they fluoroscope or steam open your mail, or steal it and carry it back to the federal building, or feed it to a goat, or whatever the hell they're going to do with it. Even if you are not intending to become active, and the address is not for publication, you need a physical mailing address where the party can send you stuff. And it must be secure in that only you receive mail there and there's no risk of nosy relatives, nosy parents, nosy spouses, nosy roommates, or nosy anyone opening the mail either by accident or deliberately in order to check up on you and try to control your life. Now, this has always been at least an occasional situation with our people, especially minors and guys in mixed marriages with Muggle women. But it is now becoming an increasingly common situation as more and more white people, especially young white males, are economically destroyed by the Obama Depression and become one of the 92 million American adults who are not working. and who can no longer afford even the rent on a crappy one-bedroomed furnished apartment or a crappy single-wide mobile home. And they have to move back in with parents or sponge off relatives and friends, or else it's the homeless shelter in the local freeway underpass. No kidding, I've had several of these cases pop up in the last few months where people holler at me to stop mailing them their Northwest Observer or their organizational letters or anything else, because all of a sudden they're in a situation where they are not collecting their own mail, and there is a chance of interception by someone who is, how shall I put this in good left-wing, liberal, politically correct terms? Someone who is in an inappropriate and unbalanced power relationship with some hapless white boy who is now on the bones of his ass, thanks to Obama, and who is dependent for the roof over his head and the food he eats on some Democrat jackass or feminist bitch or some just plain American asshole who wants to control other people's lives and tell them how to live, which is, of course, the great American national pastime. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed how so many of the problems in this society are caused by the liberals' deranged obsession with controlling other people and telling them how they have to live? I think a lot of the reason for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars was so liberal feminists over here who write blogs in New York could get an American boot on the neck of the Muslim men and make them submit to female domination. Sorry, wandering again, I know. Anyway, this is one reason why I hope that someday, when you people decide that you really do want to do this thing and you stop waiting for Godot, we actually can become, to some degree, a social welfare organization for genuinely deserving white people and help them with migration and jobs and housing, like Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood do in the Middle East, so that our people don't have to fall back on politically stupid or hostile family or other muggles in order just to keep a roof over their heads and keep body and soul together. Anyway, even if you are in some situation where you're dependent on people who will harm you if you let them know your mind is not fully under control, you need to scrape up some money from somewhere, $100 or so, and rent yourself a post office box or a UPS store or other private mailbox where you can receive mail safely and securely, or as safely and securely as anybody can these days. Yes, you'll still have to worry about mail covers, but I say again, the more work that we can generate for our friends in the silk suits, the more cracks we can all slip through. Now, this applies especially to minors. I had my first post office box at the age of 16 for this very reason, so that I could order things in the mail without risk of interception and subsequent outbreaks of hysteria and psychopathic violence at home. So, hey guys, I've been there. I know the manual also says the party has to be careful in dealing with minors, and we do, but in my view, a teenager, even though still the legal property of his or her parents in body, has the right to freedom of the mind, the right to unfettered access to ideas, and if there is a censorship problem at home, then an off-site mail drop is appropriate. You can probably tell from the way I'm rambling that I'm feeling a bit under the weather this week. Anyway, here's Olivia.
Good afternoon, comrades. Although this won't apply to most of you listening, it will unfortunately apply to some. Maybe after listening, those to whom it does apply will choose to make a change. An open letter to supporters of our leftist overlords from angrywhitedude.com. This is an open letter to those who support our leftist overlords Note, I don't say liberals, as there are plenty of conservatives who are just as guilty, and self-described liberals who refuse to be pawns. Not sure if you're a member of the intended target audience? Well, here are some simple questions, a positive answer to which signals your inclusion. Do you believe diversity and multiculturalism are the reason for being of the United States of America, as opposed to individual liberty? Do you believe a poem by some obscure poet, "Give me your tired, your poor," should dictate America's immigration policy and not, say, the U.S. Constitution for ourselves and our posterity? Do you believe the phrase that all men are created equal means that everyone is of equal ability rather than that we are all equal under the law? Do you believe that race is only a social construct, meaning that it has no biological basis? Do you believe all races are, on the whole, perfectly equal in all abilities, physically, emotionally, or intellectually? If you answered yes to any of the above questions, congratulations. You're not only an effing idiot, you're also a traitor. By your compliance, you have assisted in replacing the founding stock of this nation with third world hordes, thereby corrupting our institutions and destroying our culture. You have taken part in turning what was once envied by the world into the laughingstock of the world. You have rendered this greatest of nations in the history of nations, this greatest of civilizations in the history of civilizations, into but one more third world hellhole. Know that you were handed the greatest gift any generation in the history of humanity has ever received, and rather than capitalizing on that gift and passing on something even greater, you destroyed it in a fit of greed and indulgence and stupid, credulous naivete. Know that because of your existence, the United States of America, and by extension the rest of the world, is now a far worse place to live. Know that you have saddled your children and your children's children with debt and despair and third world pathologies like random savage criminality, poverty, and endless, hopeless chaos. Know that we who are awake to the truth now face a choice between two miserable alternatives. Either we submit to the destruction of this once great nation, or we take up arms against an entrenched and ruthless enemy, an enemy you helped cement into power. So go away from us in shame. We ask not your counsel or your arms. Crouch down and lick the hands which feed you. May your chains set lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that you were our countrymen. These are certainly some harsh words, but true nonetheless. We do face a choice between two miserable alternatives. Bow down to those who are currently controlling the world we live in today and submit to the destruction of our race, or take up arms and fight for our right to be the white men and women that we are, and to live in a world that is once again safe, sane, and free from the flow of mud. The choice is ours, and no one can make it for us. We must make it for ourselves. The fight is ours, and no one can fight the battle for us. We must fight it for ourselves. We have all the ability we need and more to do what needs to be done to make the choice, fight the battle, and create a white world once again. The first step is always the hardest, but the only way to move past the fear is actually to take that first step. I can't say it's all downhill from there because it's not, but it's never again as hard as taking that first step. I look forward to meeting you all when you arrive in the homeland. Hail victory, comrades!
One of the issues that occasionally arises among white nationalists of various tendencies is one of these how many stormtroopers can dance on the head of a pin type of things, i.e., should white nationalists ever eat ethnic food of various kinds, and are we risking our souls' eternal damnation if we ever set foot in a Taco Bell or a Chinese lunch buffet? Now, in my case, it doesn't really matter because I don't like most ethnic food, especially Mexican and most Middle Eastern and Indian. It's got nothing to do with it being non-white cuisine. It just tastes like crap to me. crap with chili powder on it, or crap with curry on it. Now, I admit I won't turn down an occasional drumstick of chicken tikka when it's offered, and I do like London-style doner kebabs, which is a Turkish dish. For those of you who've never eaten them, they're kind of like a lamb taco. And I like its Greek cousin, the gyros, or gyros, which you can get in Chicago, but you can't get either one of them out here. However, I have to confess to something here that will probably go into my file and set the goat dancers leaping and twirling in the air on occasion from now on, and that is that I do occasionally indulge in Chinese food. Not a lot of it. I'm not like your typical yuppie who lives on takeout or anything like that, but just occasionally. Anyway, one of our guys sent me the following song, possibly as a way of chastising me for my culinary heresy. Not sure. This is Weird Al Yankovic.
Did you ever think when you eat Chinese, it ain't pork or chicken but a fat Siamese? Yet the food tastes great so you don't complain, but that's not chicken in your chicken chow mein. Seems to me I ordered sweet and sour pork, but Garfield's on my fork, he's purring here on my fork. There's a cat in the kettle at the Peking Moon, the place that I eat every day at noon. They can feed your cat and you'll never know, once they wrap it up in dough, boys, they fry it real crisp in dough. Chowlin asked if I wanted more as he was dialing up his buddy at the old pet store. I said, not today, I lost my appetite. There's two cats in my belly and they want to fight. I was sucking on a Rolaid and a Tums or two, where I swear I heard it new, boys, and that is when I knew. There's a cat in the kettle at the Peking Moon, I think I gotta stop eating there at noon. They say that it's beef or fish or pork, but it's purring there on my fork. There's a hairball on my fork.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andreas Donner. Today, in a strange turn of events, I'm going to go all mushy on you and talk about feelings. I can hear your collective expression of disgust already, but it's not quite what you think, so please bear with me. The Northwest Front and I harp on the Radio Free Northwest audience almost weekly to think rather than feel. While that's perfectly valid advice and is true as far as it goes, it occurred to me this last week that we've never really explained how to go about this. For those not in the Puget Sound area with the party associates located here, personality types and behavior are repeated topics of conversation among us. It won't surprise you to find out nearly all of us lean heavily towards thinking over feeling. While a person isn't locked into one particular type of behavior across any aspect of their personality, everyone ends up with different preferences and abilities because they exercise some personality traits more so than others. As a result, other abilities tend to languish because they are not developed. It's worth noting that everyone must, on a regular basis, engage all aspects and capabilities of their personality. What ends up happening is that some capabilities are not frequently used for lack of interest. Because of this, a thinker, such as myself, might not even acknowledge emotions at all, since, at the very least, they don't make much sense. Obviously, this is the opposite of what a feeler would do, but I can't give you any first-person perspective on what that looks like. All of my commentary on Radio Free Northwest has been geared towards facts and hasn't shown any regard for the listener's emotions. Being that everything the Northwest Front has presented about our planned racial destruction falls in the realm of flat fact, no amount of feeling, wishing, or hoping is going to alter anything I or the rest of the party has said. My purpose is, instead, to attempt to help those unsure how to engage their thinking capacity in response to the results from their feeling abilities. Both thinkers and feelers can get things wrong. Thinkers can have bad information, insufficient information, and they can make leaps of logic which aren't actually valid. In the same way, feelers can also come to wrong conclusions, but for different reasons. As a thinker, I can't begrudge someone their emotions. After all, when someone talks about how they feel, the only thing they are communicating is, well, how they feel. And when I'm talking about how they feel, I'm not referring to almost always useless opinions which start with the words, "I feel that." The feelings I mean to deal with are actual emotions. As I said, feelings can misdirect a person just as much as bad thinking, but until recently that was difficult for me to comprehend. Someone sent me a psychological definition of what it is to feel, which put things in perspective. When someone says they have a particular feeling on a subject, and again, I mean actual emotions, not badly worded opinions, what they are actually communicating is how acceptable or unacceptable an issue, event, or situation is to them personally. As I said, I can't begrudge someone their emotions because, firstly, by definition, we're talking about their emotions, and secondly, an emotion simply represents their orientation to whatever is generating that emotion. All a person's emotions really communicate is another fact, even if that fact is their own personal state of being. If emotions really reveal a person's orientation to an issue, event, or situation, how can they lead someone astray? The underlying assumption inherent in following one's feelings is that they, personally, are oriented correctly to a particular subject. Admittedly, were this so, then a person's instantaneous reaction of how acceptable or unacceptable something is to them would almost certainly be the right one. Here's where the party's past rhetoric comes into play. This business about becoming different people, specifically the people who are capable of bringing the Northwest American Republic into being, is exactly what we've been talking about. Before I get to the heavy stuff, though, it would be best to convince you all it's possible to have the wrong feeling on a subject. When children are assigned their first chores by their parents, they're never very happy about it. Their feelings aside, every adult knows children need to start learning to work. Years later, people see why they were wrong to avoid this life lesson. School children aren't too fond of their homework, particularly when it's boring. Later in life, they might not be too fond of it all the same, but they're mature enough to know it's good for them. There are a lot of anecdotes about young members of the workforce failing in their workplace duties because they don't have positive feelings about the situation they're in, and only start performing when they've got some experience under their belts. Obviously, the subjects of the feelings haven't changed. Rather, the people in question change themselves and therefore change their orientation to those subjects. This is what the Northwest Front needs white people to do, but actively rather than passively. As I've said before, I found the party at the right time in my own personal development such that I was immediately able to evaluate its claims and proposals so that I could ultimately accept the Northwest Imperative and come home to the Pacific Northwest. In every case where someone has refused the Butler Plan, it's been emotional and not based on logic. I know there are certain situations where a person can be attached to a place for various reasons outside their control, but the vast majority of refusals the party encounters are veiled emotional rejections of migration itself. These refusals are probably due to as many different reasons as there are people making them. Some of them are even for decent reasons, such as a strange type of patriotism which requires fealty to America. Most, though, are due to emotional attachment to personal things, such as homes, people, or possessions. Again, I'm not judging the emotions themselves since, like I pointed out earlier, an emotion is just an indication of how acceptable something is to you. When I found the party, I had been political for years and racial long enough to think things through enough that I had let go of emotional attachments to my own goals and even to the damned American experiment itself. When I say I found the party at the right time in my personal development, I mean just that. It was a maturity issue. The issue wasn't what the party was saying or doing. Rather, it was my own personal readiness to put aside any emotional attachments I had and make mature, responsible decisions regardless of how upsetting they were. Like a lot of other examples of emotional maturity, I'm glad many things in my life happened the way they did or else I might not have ever found the party. I won't go into the details here since that would take an absurd amount of time, but there are a lot of things I wasn't very happy about at the time they happened. They all later turned out to be very critical to my racial and political development, and now I wouldn't trade them for anything, regardless of how emotionally disconcerting they were in the past. Just because you don't like something, or the implications of that thing, doesn't mean it isn't the right thing for you to do. If it's not clear by now, the way to approach things you emotionally reject is to ask yourself why you feel that way. And when you come up with an answer, ask yourself if that's a good reason not to participate in the only plan which could actually save our race from physical extinction. And further, ask yourself if your own personal attachment to the subject at hand is a mature, appropriate one, especially in light of your political and racial beliefs. I bet the answer is no. If not, ask yourself how you would feel defending the choice to prefer whatever it is over your race's existence. If you're any sort of white nationalist, you'll be able to change your orientation towards the Northwest Imperative and begin the migration process. Hail victory, comrades.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm very excited to discuss Richard Tidor's book with you, and this is a book called Hitler's Revolution. And this really deals with the ideological foundations of the Third Reich. What this book really makes clear is that the National Socialist ideology doesn't really fit into the categories of liberal or conservative in some sense. It's not a liberal ideology because it's not about the individual primarily. It's about the group. But it's also not a conservative ideology because socially it is a socialist ideology. And when you study this history and ideological foundations, you'll find that there were a lot of social programs that were very much like the social programs that were instigated in the States in the 30s. Although the German programs were run with much more economic efficiency, apparently. These programs had a lot to do with elevating labor, and they also had to do with creating food independence for Germany. And it encouraged families to work the land, but it also helped to give laborers better working conditions. And also improved housing. Now, as an architect, to a certain degree, Hitler was involved in these housing plans. This plan for housing had to do with strengthening the family and the community. It's even been said by some historians that basically Reich really had a peacetime economy. It really wasn't particularly prepared for war. But you also have to understand that there were a lot of German aristocrats and also English aristocrats that really did not like what Hitler was doing because he was really attempting to create a meritocracy, both in terms of the Waffen-SS and also the Hitler schools. Both of these groups were really taught to think very independently. And also, this book talks about how because the economy within the Reich was really very good, there were many people, and certainly a lot of Germanic people, living around Germany in both Austria and the Sudetenland that really wanted to join the Reich. And then there were even some people outside of that area that wanted to also be included in the Reich because, again, of the wonderful economic opportunities that they saw there. So as more and more people wanted to come into the Reich, there were more and more diplomatic issues. Plus, there were issues of resources. Germany doesn't have a lot of resources of its own, so there was a concern with, I suppose, things like oil and other types of resources. A combination of concern for various Germanic peoples living elsewhere and a need for resources and for reasons of, I suppose, political maneuvering and alliances, and also an unfortunate failure of diplomacy. Given the fact that Hitler, again, he had a lot of opposition, really led to the situation of the Second World War coming out of control. And the last part of the book is really rather depressing because you learn about a lot of saboteurs, a lot of aristocrats that really, I suppose because of their own greed, really did not like what Hitler was doing. He was doing a lot of things that we today might consider liberal. For example, there was a national health care system. There was also, interestingly enough, because Germany was very poor, Hitler actually took Germany off the gold standard, and within the country, a person's earnings had to do with how much they were able to devote to their job, how much of their time and effort they were able to devote to their jobs, and internationally, a kind of barter system. So a lot of times we think of people on the far right as loving the gold standard, but actually Hitler apparently was not really interested in the gold standard. And there were a lot of people that were threatened by this. So again, it really shows National Socialism is a very eclectic view, and it's really not a libertarian view or particularly a conservative view. So I really found this book to be very illuminating, and I really wanted to talk about it, particularly after I discussed Hepparta's book, because that book claimed that the Reich was unable to improve its economy. The National Socialist ideas were unable to lift Germany out of the Depression and out of all the problems with the Versailles Treaty. And I just had to present this other point of view because I just didn't want to let that idea stand, to let someone badmouth him. So I was really excited to discuss this book, and I wanted to discuss it anyway. I just got to a point where I just felt that I had to discuss it. Honestly, it's one of the few places where you're going to find an analysis of the social programs and the ideology and an analysis of foreign affairs. But as I said, the last part does get to be depressing, and you'll find out about a lot of saboteurs, particularly people in something called the Abwehr Group. And that was a group that was supposed to give all kinds of foreign intelligence. It really had quite a number of traitors who were well placed. And if anything, I would have to say there was far too much toleration of their either treason or maybe in some cases incompetence, but oftentimes people who were treasonous. You know, often we think of the Third Reich as being this brutal dictatorship, but if anything, it seems to have gone too easy on some people, to be quite honest, at least according to this author. Although at times, of course, a little depressing when you think about the world today. This was one of those books that I was really passionate about and was very excited to bring to you. So thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this review.
Here's a number from the early 1960s folk revival. Now, this is by request. Interesting chorus, don't you think? This is The Seekers.
Alone, and we'll live in a world of our own.
Last week, I talked about the idea of white nationalists using what leftists call entryism into the Republican Party. Now, the communists have, of course, been practicing entryism into the mainstream Democratic parties in Europe for years. In this country, the Comintern, or Communist International, acting through people like Franklin Roosevelt and Alger Hiss, successfully hijacked the Democratic Party in 1933, and they've been in control of it ever since. There have been a few efforts on our part to carry out a corresponding infiltration of the Republicans, none of them having much success. Because, as always, when we try to do something subtle, we trip over our own shoelaces. I probably came the closest myself in the late 1970s and early 1980s in North Carolina, when I ran for office in Republican primaries and racked up a few passable vote totals, but that's not what I'm talking about. Now, let me take another crack at explaining what I mean here. The point here is not to do what I did and just run for office as a publicity stunt. Although, as a last resort to break the blackout, we could try that here in the Northwest. Now, the primary reason for our getting involved in the whole two-party rivalry, which is going to heat up to the boiling point this year, is because right now Democrat GOP bashing has finally led to a situation where, within certain parameters, race is no longer completely taboo as a subject of discussion. Now, rather than me sit here and spend the rest of this podcast trying to explain all this myself, I need you people to hop on your Googles and check out three websites: Huffington Post, Salon Magazine, and The Daily Beast. I need all of you to become regular readers of these websites, even though it will play havoc with your blood pressure, drive you into madness, and you will come away from them in a homicidal rage, wanting to strangle these people with your bare hands. Because here you will see the agenda laid out in public, and you will begin to understand the potential for the kind of manipulation that I'm talking about, if we can start using our heads for a change. Now, you will note that this new liberal intellectual elite of the Internet are screaming their hatred at Republicans openly, calling them racists and white supremacists and homophobes and misogynists and a bunch of old white male fuddy-duddies who need to be exterminated so that power can be taken over, mostly by arrogant feminist bitches like Arianna Huffington and Joan Walsh from Salon, along with a lot of bugger boys and fat sloppy negresses. Now, you will note that, as I've said, within the carefully controlled parameters that they allow, race and gender domination are now discussable for their purposes. Now, what we need to do is to try and make sure that the conversation, as the liberals call themselves shouting down their opposition, is twisted into, shall we say, unapproved pathways outside the acceptable parameters. Interestingly, this new liberal elite has nowhere near as many Jews as you might think at first. Now, that's another thing we need to internalize. Zionism is actually falling out of favor in the new liberal elite, which I know is movement heresy, since movement orthodoxy claims that the Jews are all-powerful, all-knowing, all-seeing, and will be forever and ever. Amen. But that's a topic for another time. Now, how do we do this? We need to use the fact that race is now discussable to make sure that our people start discussing it. Not just the problem, but the solution, which is a country of our own here in the Pacific Northwest. Now, I'm not completely opposed to running political candidates as publicity stunts, but the trouble is we'd have to have some really good candidates. Now, for various reasons I can't get into here, it can't be me who does the running this time. So this is one area where we can't just sit around waiting for Godot. Somebody else finally has to step forward and put himself into the line of fire, or else it doesn't happen. What I'm referring to by white nationalist entryism is not so much diddling with electoral politics, which are by definition useless, as finding ways to insert ourselves into the rising internal American conflict between the two primary factions or tendencies within the establishment power elite: communism as represented by the Democrats and capitalism as represented by the Republicans. I am not suggesting for one second that the Republicans are any better for white people than the Democrats. They most certainly are not. Who the hell do you think originally brought all the illegal aliens here for their cheap labor? Now, are we clear on this? Please do not send me emails accusing me of creeping Rush Limbaugh-ism or whatever, because it's not true. What I am suggesting is that we throw a few jokers into this stacked deck and we start working the game for our own purposes. These are the same two ideological and economic tendencies which have dominated the world for the past century and which are now playing out their final battle here in the America of Barack Hussein Obama. And if he chooses to leave office in 2016, after him will come Hillary Clinton, the sea hag. Communism has to some degree lost everywhere else in the world. Even Cuba and North Korea aren't true communist states. Cuba's basically run by a group of geriatric gangsters like Raul Castro, and North Korea's official ideology isn't actually communism. It's something called Juche, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, which basically means that the hereditary party chairman of the Kim family is an emperor, a kind of divine being. In other words, traditional Oriental government. Throughout the world, communism is in the process of losing it all. Europe's social democracy, so-called, in other words, communism light, are all in the process of collapsing due to massive third world immigration and general economic incompetence. Germany, where they still actually make things, has been keeping Europe going like Atlas with the world on its shoulders. Eventually, the rest of Europe and all of those millions of Africans and Muslims will drag Germany down as well. It's like Margaret Thatcher said, the problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. That's already happening here. The United States has run out of other people's money. The Democrats can only keep up the fraud and smoke and mirrors through the Federal Reserve, printing more monopoly money to buy back its own debt, and they can only do this for so long. The last remaining accessible, taxable, and collectible reserves of private wealth in this country are in the hands of middle-aged and elderly white people, and Obama and Hillary are coming for it soon. There's an old saying, the middle class always pays the taxes because the poor can't pay and the rich won't. Now, Obama and the sea hag are also trying to get at the vast wealth which is held by the multinational corporations, but that is what the Republican Party is there to preserve. They're kind of like the dragon Smaug in his cave guarding all that vast mountain of gold and jewels and treasure. Even with 5 years in power, so far the Democrats have only been able to nibble at the edges of all that vast corporate wealth, and it's driving them nuts. The Democrats want that wealth to buy black and brown votes with. They want it so bad they can taste it, but it's too well guarded by those Republican dragons in Congress in their expensive suits. Those Republicans will fight to the death to make sure that the 1% and the corporations don't have to pay a single penny to buy more votes for the Democrats. But they will not lift a finger to protect the white elderly and the white middle class, which is why that's the money that Obama and the Democrats have been draining like gigantic leeches for the past 5 years. Now, that's the money that Hillary will drain away completely if Obama can be persuaded to leave office in 2016 and finally give the sea hag her turn. Okay, yes, I know, that's oversimplifying things and we need to move on, but basically that's what's been happening. So, what do I suggest we do? Use this one window of space here in the media, where race is, to a certain degree, discussable, to actually discuss race. Now, first off, as much as I hate to say it, this is where we're going to have to become masters of the Internet, because it is the only mass medium of communication that the NF has any access to at all. We are completely blacked out on cable television and in what remains of the newspapers and print media, and also on all the major websites that actually have any readership. In the year 2012, NorthwestFront.org received almost exactly 200,000 unique visits. In 2013, we beat that, but not by too damn much, largely due to the internet purge or sweep of all our links, which began in mid-August of that year. Now, right now, the object of all internet activism on everybody's part has to be to bring people to NorthwestFront.org. Always remember our primary problem. We in the Northwest Front have the solution that millions of white people have been searching for. Yes, they have been searching for us. But they don't know where to find us, because they don't even know that we exist. They don't even know the name of Northwest Front. That has to change, and the most promising way to let people know that we exist is to use the one sector of the internet where discussion of race, any discussion of race, is permissible. The Democratic Party's hate campaign against the Republicans, whom they hate so badly for guarding the corporation's wealth and keeping all that lovely corporate money out of their grubby little taxing hands. Now, we're going to have to get creative here. I'm not going to give you guys a primer on how to use the left-wing liberal internet and media to break their own blackout. Basically, you have to give them something that they can't ignore, or that gets them so upset that they lose their cool. Commander Rockwell used the swastika, which he proved time and again is the one thing that they absolutely cannot ignore, but we no longer do that, so that's out. Now, I'll give you a tip. I myself have tried the next best thing, which is using the word nigger in public. I have a list of about 150 top media people here in the Northwest whom I notify every week when Radio Free Northwest comes out, and to whom I also send press releases and certain Northwest Revolution news stories, and I use the word nigger in the subject line to get their attention. I figure maybe when they're looking for a token racist interview, they'll choose one who'll say nigger, but that doesn't work either. For the past several years, I have received not response one, at least not any real responses. All that's happened so far is a few of them have sent me nasty emails saying, take me off your list, you wicked evil man, you. You see, it's not that the media, or some of them anyway, don't know that we're here. They do. I made sure of that. It's that we are deliberately blacked out because they know that white people do, in fact, want to hear what we have to say, and they don't want that to happen at all. And when it does happen, they want to control the process. Now, the one thing that the establishment fears is that white people will start discovering NorthwestFront.org and NorthwestFront.net on their own, and they'll start communicating directly with the party, not filtering that contact through the media. However, feel free to try this yourselves. Experiment, guys. Get creative. Mess with those liberal blogs and websites until they ban you, and then try and get back on. Now, the one time that we got any national media publicity in this country was in 2011 during the Bionic Backpack incident in Spokane, and what happened then was that Rachel Maddow found NorthwestFront.org, and she blew a gasket. And for 2 days, we were top billing on her stupid show, and then somebody gave her a call and informed her that we're blacklisted, and she fell silent and shut down the threads on her website. But what if we were able to get some big cheese liberal media fruitcake so enraged and upset by the very fact that we exist at all that he or she started ranting and raving about us wicked, violent Northwest white revolutionaries in public and won't shut up even when they're ordered to by whoever runs the blacklist within the media establishment? Salon and HuffPost did a number on Craig Cobb. But Craig Cobb was a carefully selected idiot, possibly even placed there deliberately for that purpose, like a rodeo clown whose job is to distract the bulls. The Northwest Front is a horse of a different color because we have the plan. We have what white people want. I would just love to somehow lock Joan Walsh from Salon or Chris Matthews or Arianna Huffington or John Stewart into a room with a copy of The Brigade and not let them out until they actually sat down and read the book cover to cover and understood its import. And they got so screaming hysterical mad over it that they give it to us hammer and tongs on their websites and their shows, and they will not shut up, even when they're ordered to do so. Any way we can make that happen? Now, we need to open a whole big can of Aryan creativity and initiative on this. Now, maybe some of you guys can have better success with it than I've had. Maybe I just haven't picked the right journalists. Now, you know, guys, it's not like I'm asking you to fly to the moon. I'm asking you to do what you do best. Play with your computers. We can do this. We're white boys, and we can do whatever we want to do. It's who we are. This is Stan Rogers.
He went down last October in a pouring driving rain. The skipper, he'd been drinking and the mate, he felt no pain. Too close to Three Mile Rock and she was dealt her mortal blow. And the Mary Ellen Carter settled low. There was just us five aboard her when she finally was awash. We'd worked like hell to save her, all heedless of the cost.
And the groan she gave as she went down, it caused us to proclaim that the Mary Ellen Carter would rise again. Well, the owners wrote her off, not a nickel would they spend. She gave 20 years of service, boys, that met her sorry end. But insurance paid the loss to us, so let her rest below. Then they laughed at us and said we had to go. But we talked of her all winter, some days around the clock. She's worth a quarter million afloat and at the dock. And with every jar that hit the bar, we swore we would remain and make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Rise again, rise again. Let her name not be lost to the knowledge of men. All those who loved her best and were with her till the end will make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Spring now we've been with her on a barge lent by a friend. Three dives a day in a hard hat suit, and twice I've had the bends. Thank God it's only 60 feet and the currents here are slow, or I'd never have the strength to go below. But we patched her rents, stopped her men's dog hatch and porthole down, put cables to her fore and aft and girded her around. Tomorrow noon we hit the air and the strain and make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Rise again, rise again. Let her name not be lost to the knowledge of men. All those who loved her best and were with her till the end will make the Mary Ellen Carter rise again. Leave her there, you see, to crumble into scale. She'd saved our lives so many times, living through the gale. And the laughing drunken rats who left her to a sorry grave, they won't be laughing in another day. And you, to whom adversity has dealt the final blow, with smiling bastards lying to you everywhere you go, turn to and put out all your strength of arm and heart and brain, and like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again. Rise again, rise again. Though your heart it be broken or life about to end, no matter what you've lost, be it a home, a love, a friend, like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again. Rise again, rise again. Though your heart it be broken or life about to end, no matter what you've lost, be it a home, a love, a friend, like the Mary Ellen Carter, rise again.
Napoleon once said, revolution is an idea that has found bayonets. We have the idea right here in the Northwest Front. We are the only ones who do. In the past 60 years, there have been exactly two genuine plans that have been produced by our wee little movement. The first was Commander Rockwell's campaign to mount a serious third-party presidential election bid in 1972. He was beginning to work on this plan in the months before his death in 1967, which included ditching a lot of the Phase One tactics, which we still practice today. It never got off the ground because Rockwell was murdered, quite possibly in order to prevent him from implementing Phase Two successfully, and thus getting American National Socialism into position to possibly become a serious player. The old party then wasted another 15 years on Phase One tactics until Cale took the money and ran off to his retirement estate in Wisconsin. Interestingly, Rockwell's plan required engagement with system politics, something our wee little movement has always avoided like the plague, probably because the real world is big and bad and mean and it frightens us. I don't think anyone seriously believed that Rockwell could win, most likely not even Rockwell himself, but a major third-party campaign in 1972 could have been used as a vehicle to build up a serious, nationwide white resistance movement. We'll never know now, of course, whether or not it would have worked, but it was the last chance we had for some kind of all-America solution. The second actual plan we've come up with in all these years is Northwest migration. By default, in the complete absence of any other, that's what we have to go with. Now, we know what we're going to do now. We have the idea now, and that means we need to start looking around for the bayonets. This means engaging at least to some degree with the actual political process in this country, and I don't blame you for wanting to avoid it. It's like sticking your head in a stopped-up toilet. It is unquestionably so much more satisfying, not to mention safer, to get out of these horrible cities and run off to some compound way, way out in the boondocks, where we can sit amidst the beauty of nature and think calm, nice, pure thoughts. Maybe even great thoughts. And then the old man kicks it, and the buzzards descend to rend the carcass, and finally, whoever ends up with the boodle ends up selling everything off to support his lifestyle. Now, that cannot and must not happen with the Northwest Front. The Northwest Independence Movement must be first and foremost grounded out here in the real world, which is why I so despise our current dependence on the Internet, and why I would so love to see things like a tabloid newspaper and massive leaflet distributions carried out by actual human bodies, which it don't look like I'm going to get anytime soon, but you got to play the cards you're dealt. Now, one of the places where we are going to have to go in search of our revolution's bayonets will be the fragmenting factions of the Republican Party as it implodes through electoral defeat after defeat, as it will do because normal people are now outnumbered at the polls by the artificially created black, brown, and pauperized white underclass, whose votes have been purchased with food stamps, Section 8 housing, Obama phones, Obama flat-screen TVs, and eventually with foreclosed houses through the FHA or some other government body. Now, it's hard to vote against your landlord and the people who control your EBT card. So the Republicans are going to implode. Now, there might be one last mighty effort put forth in 2014, kind of like a dying beast puts forth in its death throes before succumbing. But that as well will pose some interesting possibilities for us and create some interesting scenarios. Now, this country is headed for a political meltdown and chaos no matter what. And somewhere in that ghastly mess, we will find our revolution's bayonets. But for now, our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.